Ridiculous History is a production of iHeartRadio.
Welcome to the show, Ridiculous Historians. As always, thank you so much for tuning in. Today's episode is especially dedicated to Ilurophiles, a word I just learned that means lover of cats.
Ben, I thought you were about to say a word I just made up, but it sounds too fancy and sciencey for that to be the case. I don't know this word either, Ben.
Yeah, it's A-I-L-U-R-O-File. Also, a cat fancier. We've got a bunch of fans of cats, dogs, pets, animals in general in the crowd today. And note here that my pal Noel and I are ourselves cat owners, so this will necessarily be a two-part episode. You know, there's always been this kind of, I would say, a false divide between dog lovers and cat lovers. There are some people who feel like those things are mutually exclusive, but Noel, I see it in some people, but usually I disagree. I think especially the rise of the cat memes and videos online have done a lot for the reputations of our feline friends. What would you say?
I would agree with that. And Ben, I was reminded just the other day of a little brief period in cat internet meme video culture where people were spooking their cats with cucumbers. Mm-hmm. You guys remember this?
Mm-hmm.
There seemed to be a very universal reaction. Cats would not only get spooked, they would just jump straight up in the air. I'm assuming they thought it was a snake or something like that. But yeah, I don't know why that popped out from my mental index the other day. But I went and looked at like a nice supercut of all of them. And sure enough, every single cat jumped straight up in the air. But it's true, Ben. Cats, the internet has really made cats kind of a universal thing, whether it's like your grumpy cat, your little bub. Remember little bub when we were owned by Discovery Channel? He was technically our coworker.
Yes. And while you're on the internet, by the way, you can also go to TeePublic and check out our Ridiculous History swag featuring a t-shirt with none other than super producer Casey Pegram. Casey, I don't want people to equate you with little bub. We make high quality memes here at Ridiculous History.
Only the best memes here.
Only the best. Yeah, for the longest time, I thought it was little bubs, but it is not plural. He's just a single bub. But you know, the thing about cats too is the expression herding cats comes to mind as possibly a good argument for why maybe cat shows aren't as much of a thing as dog shows. Dogs can be trained. They prance around on command. They're much more beholden to their masters. Cats are kind of notoriously fickle and kind of do whatever they want. And I'm assuming there still are cat shows, but you don't really hear about them in the same way as you would, like, say, the Westminster Dog Show. But it turns out that we can pinpoint the world's very first cat show. And it wasn't held in Westminster, mind you, but it was held at the St. Giles Fair in Winchester, also in England, in 1598.
It's true. We don't know much about this first cat show other than that date. In fact, some historians challenge whether it occurred at all, but we know that in the following years, other cat owners may have hosted similar, somehow lesser known affairs. The event that finally put cat shows on the map was a national competition at London's Crystal Palace in 1871. And a huge reason for feline popularity in the UK after that time was a man named Harrison Weir. He was an artist. He was also the father of cat fancy. That is his name. That's how he's known. He is responsible for writing the first pedigree cat book with the lovely title, Our Cats and All About Them. He also founded the UK National Cat Club. You know, the thing with breeding animals and dog shows and there's also a contest for like the most beautiful goat in some country. I can't remember which one. The thing about all those shows is they set standards for specific cat breeds. So like a Persian cat then gets this quantifiable list of things that make them the most Persian of cats, or what's the most Jellicle of cats, right? Am I getting that right? Jellicle?
The Jellicle cats, the most absurd concept in all of Broadway musical history. What does it even mean? What is a Jellicle cat? Nobody knows.
I watched the first, not the entirety, but maybe the first segment of the live action Cats. Have you guys seen it?
Yeah, it's nightmare fuel, my friend. It is not good, and dare I say, actively uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm. You know, like I'm a proponent of personal liberty in many situations. So even if drugs aren't for me, I think it's fine for people to experiment. I just don't think it should affect your work.
Mm, yeah, it's true. What's the guy's name? Toby something? Tom Hooper is his name. Odd choice with that one. He really went down the Broadway rabbit hole. The King's Speech was a fine little film, and then his Les Mis is quite good, actually. But this was just, he really jumped the cat on this one. And can you imagine if they had left the buttholes in? I want to see that cut. There's apparently a cut where the weird anthropomorphized, over-sexualized cat people have cat buttholes.
I heard that. I heard that from one of my friends who got a little bit steamed with me because he saw Cats in the theater. Remember, this came out pre-pandemic, and I was roasting him about it. And I was like, you secretly love this film. And he said, no, here are some facts about it. And he's the one who hipped me to the infamous butthole edit, which is sort of like the Snyder edit of Cats.
Exactly. It's a very, it's going to come out eventually. I saw it in the theaters too, by the way, with my kid.
Oh,
and
wow.
Both throughout the whole thing, we were just looking at each other like uncomfortably, just like, what even is this? But you know, I won't walk out of a movie no matter how unbearably bad it is. But here's the thing, Cats, the musical, has always kind of had a bit of a bad rap. It's very, very, very popular, but very perplexing. A lot of people don't get it. It's a little odd. It's not, you know, it seems like the kind of Broadway show that was very much the product of the time and cocaine, I'm going to argue. But, you know, it made a lot of money. It was one of the longest running Broadway shows in history. Cats, as a species, also got a bit of a bad rap throughout history, didn't they?
That's right. And, you know, staying on Cats, the adaptation, for just one moment, my primary question watching this, I want to open this to the rest of our fellow ridiculous historians, is what would T.S. Eliot think? Would he dig it? Would he be like, 4.5 stars, where are the buttholes? I don't know. It's a question lost to history. But you are right about Cats, Noel. They've been a divisive creature in human culture. Part of their behavior can be explained by the fact that cats appear to have domesticated themselves rather than having been bred into domestication, the way wolves eventually were bred into dogs.
Yeah, further proof that they do not need us.
Right, right. Well, it's just human beings being a relatively filthy species generated a lot of trash, which generates a lot of vermin, which works out for cats. Anyway, we know that cats have gone through ups and downs in their career. They have been at times lauded as sacred beings, and they have been also, you know, the subject of much mistrust. In ancient Egypt, people loved cats. This is proven conclusively in the archaeological record. In fact, a fun thing I learned recently, the word for cats in ancient Egyptian was mau, or like meow, M-A-U.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
That's where the onomatopoeia of a cat sound came from, huh?
There's some meme out there. You guys got to see it where you learned the ancient Egyptian word for cat was mau. And it's like you picture an ancient Egyptian saying, what the heck are you? And the cat goes, meow. And they go, all right.
Yeah. See, they even named themselves. Totally don't need us. We are absolutely an afterthought. But the Egyptians did need cats. That's the thing. Much more than the cats needed them, because they were basically worshipped, right? Many of their goddesses and the pantheon of like Egyptian kind of deities had anthropomorphic animal type features. And Bastet was an ancient Egyptian goddess of love who had the head of a cat. So, therefore, the killing of a cat in Egypt was a big no-no. it would actually be punishable by death. I'm pretty sure a lot of things in ancient Egypt were probably punishable by death, but killing a cat was definitely one of them.
Absolutely. And this this care for cats was something that ancient Romans would have recognized. Their love of felines was a little bit more secular because cats were seen as a symbol of liberty. And then even more practical, the further east you go, in the Far East, cats were considered valuable to society because they hunted rodents that could otherwise damage manuscripts and documents. And then, for some reason, cats got a really bad image in Europe during the Middle Ages. You know what we're talking about? Black cats, witches, black mass.
Yeah, the old image of the cats is like a witch's trusty familiar. The idea that they were somehow a liaison, you know, between the practitioner of black magic and the devil himself. So this was a time. This was basically a cat apocalypse where they were just killed left and right in a completely misplaced effort to, you know, vanquish evil, right? And when I say misplaced, I mean not only ideologically, but also practically, because it caused the rodent infestation to absolutely swell and led to, you got it, the Black Plague.
This dislike of cats continues in Europe for some time. You can read no small amount of dissertations arguing various reasons why cats got such a bad rep in this part of the world. Over at the Boston Globe, in their article, The Crazy History of the Cat Lady, they point out that some scholars argue cats have been part of households as pest control since humans settled into the agricultural era. That's true. But they remained aloof, and because they were not domesticated or assimilated into the social hierarchy the same way dogs were, this may have upset the Christian hierarchical ordering of life on earth at the time, which was like man at top and then other things. So cats, who were kind of in this liminal space between the wild and the domestic, were always going to be a little bit sus. Also, we should mention, speaking of a more brutal time, Noel, when you said a lot of things may have gotten you the death penalty in Egypt, a lot of animals were frequently tortured or killed for sport. So people who were overly into cats were also seen as kind of sus. Like, hey, we torture these things for fun. You're getting real weird, Agnes or Tobias or whatever.
Which is strange, because cats, like you said, throughout history have always served a really functional role. Even in the Middle Ages, they killed vermin, mice, rats, and the like. Things that would have potentially contaminated people's food supply or water, or just, you know, they're kind of gross, and you definitely don't want them crawling all over your house. So, bad rap aside, cats absolutely have always kind of like played an important role, because, I mean, dogs, I guess, will do that kind of, or you can train them to do it, but it's not something they just kind of have a natural inclination to. And cats will do it whether you want them to or not. I used to have an indoor-outdoor cat that would just constantly leave weird, speaking of cats being liaisons of the devil, would leave weird vivisected animal parts at my front stoop, like, literally, almost like a staged serial killer crime scene from like Seven or something. It was quite horrific and terrifying. So only indoor cats for me from now on. There's a really great quote from William Caxton about this relationship that cats have with little creatures like that. And it goes, "The devil playeth oft with the saner, like as the cat doth with the mouse." So there you go.
The idea being that cats catching mice are employing tactics similar to how the devil catches human souls. It's a bit of a leap. Later we'll find as a species that this behavior, which is very common in cats, this behavior of giving mostly dead or dead animals to their human pals, is somewhere between trying to teach you to hunt, the implication being that you suck at hunting, or trying to feed you. So their intentions are good, but they're wildly misread. And I can understand that. Like, nobody's, why are you bringing me this? By the 12th century or so, people really normalized this association with felines and the devil. Around 1180, Walter Mapp published something wherein he examines his ideas of satanic rituals. And he says, it goes down like this.
The devil descends as a black cat before his devotees. The worshippers put out the light and draw near to the place where they saw their master. They feel after him, and when they have found him, they kiss him under the tail.
So,
sorry?
So they're like cat butt kissing. That's what Walter Mapp thought happened during these satanic rituals. And then you would think, okay, maybe this is just an artifact of the times, right? Maybe this is just a fad that goes away. But it didn't change post-Middle Ages, did it, Noel?
No, it didn't at all. In fact, it got worse. Cats became even more linked with black magic and witchery and all of that. Agnes Waterhouse, who was the first woman in England who was executed for witchcraft in 1566, confessed to having a cat and keeping it as a familiar, which I love that term, by the way. A familiar being just an animal kind of that you keep, that a witch keeps around or a wizard keeps around. And you know, usually you can use them to, I almost act as like a surrogate, kind of like they'll do your bidding, you know, in theory or whatever, or they'll like do things for you, or they'll, you know, potentially do things, you know, to others on your behalf. It's interesting. I'd love to hear a little bit more about the history of that term familiar. But reporting on this at the time said that Waterhouse called the cat Satan and actually set it to kill her husband in return for feeding it her own blood. Yikes.
Yeah. Without knowing the details of their marriage, maybe it's unfair for us to assume that was not a deal on the up and up. You know, maybe it made sense. Maybe it made sense when you had all the factors together.
Well, like maybe he had it coming.
Maybe. So here we are. Cats have already had some skyrocketing social highs and some physically dangerous social lows. If you fast forward to the 1860s, the average cat is considered like lower working class now because they catch rats, and you shouldn't have rats in a nice house. So they're street animals. They're considered useful because they hunt vermin, but they're not really considered like cute, cuddly companion animals. Even Charles Darwin complains about them in On the Origin of the Species. And Windsor Magazine says that they're just a necessary household appendage. So if you think about it, back at that time, snuggling with a cat would be like having a really deep emotional relationship with your blender. It didn't make sense to people. They might not burn you at the stake anymore, but they would be like, wow, blender lady is weird.
Absolutely. And even moreover, the fact that they were seen as unclean because of their relationship with vermin and the fact that they always were killing them, one would assume that they, you know, are covered in that same kind of filth. Which, to be fair, if you have an outdoor cat, you're probably snuggling with a cat that has, you know, vivisected creatures out in the wild. So word to the wise there. But anyway, it's interesting as time goes on, cats become polarizing, interestingly enough. Like, I mean, they kind of always already have been a little bit, but this is, it really like takes it to the next level. There's an absolute split on people's opinions about cats in the 19th century.
Yeah. So at the beginning of what we call the Victorian era today, cats and animals in general were becoming more and more popular. If you went to a classy Victorian home, you would see plants, you would see animals. And if people were really bawling out, you would see some fish. This is also, by the way, the age where the garden hermit fad took off. You guys remember that from our earlier episode where you just paid somebody to be weird at your backyard?
Just to hang out in your garden. Yeah, very strange. Big, that was on our Weird Flex episode, I believe, yeah?
Yes, I believe that's correct. That, by the way, quick sidebar, there's this guy in Japan who figured out this amazing thing. He was my hero of the week a few weeks ago. There's a guy, he's working right now. I know this because we're Twitter friends. He's working right now where you can rent him to do nothing. He will hang out with you. He will respond to simple, non-philosophical questions, and he will just sort of go do stuff that you, he will go stand around while you do stuff. What's that guy's name?
Looks like it's Shoji Morimoto.
That's right. Casey on the case.
So he's like a professional, like, guy on the couch. He's a professional mooch, essentially.
Yeah. He's a professional, just hang out with you, companion person. I guess he's kind of a professional cat. Anyhow, shout out to you, sir. There's a great Vice article about him if you'd like to learn more. So there's this interesting thing. So some scholars, like author Kathleen Keat, who wrote The Beast in the Boudoir, Pet Keeping in 19th Century Paris, argue that there's a compensation thing going on here in the upper class. They're saying that the people who are really classy, the pet owners, were in fact compensating for their inability to control the lower working classes of humans. So they would put that desire for domination into keeping pets and plants.
That is brilliant. What a power move. Yeah, it's like, okay, you can't, you know, you can't exercise any autonomy over your own life. So here, have this like small creature to take care of and exert dominance over. That's fantastic. I can relate. Honestly, I think that sentiment still holds true a little bit today. So here's the thing. As this kind of, oh, I don't know, I guess you could call it Renaissance of cats, pets in general, but cats in particular, came around. There was a kind of a new movement established to give them, to treat them more like members of the family instead of just like furniture or, you know, functional kind of doers like rat catchers.
Roombas.
Exactly, rat Roombas. This idea of kind of imbuing them with feelings and emotions and that they were like one of us, this became a thing. In 1850, the Gramman Law in France officially prohibited the abuse of animals there, which is a big deal. It seems like, duh, like that's something that we take for granted, the idea of animal cruelty. But to your point, Ben, earlier, in the Middle Ages and beyond, animals, cats in particular, were very universally tortured.
Yeah, absolutely. It was an accepted fact of life. So we're going to dive into this. Where do we get this weird social thing about cat ladies, quote unquote? The bond between women and cats seems to become even more pronounced during the 19th century, at least in terms of social acknowledgement of it. Mm-hmm. So a lot of people had said that there was something specifically between female members of the human species, as they identified at the time, and cats in A History of French Passions, Anxiety and Hypocrisy, Volume 5, by the way, France. Sorry, Casey. It's just crazy there are five volumes of this. Have you ever heard of this book?
I have not. I'm intrigued, but I have to say I'm probably not likely to read it.
Okay, cool. I'll give you... I don't know if I'm going to read Volume 1 and 4. It may prejudice us against the country, but...
It's okay. We can just excerpt.
So Theodore Zeldin, the author of this book, notes that many contemporaneous observers said women are lavishing affection on all kinds of animals, especially cats, because it's a refuge from the brutality and all the terrible behavior they have to accept from men. That's crazily enough, that's the positive spin. There's a negative spin here as well.
Oh boy, is there ever. And I just want to say that this the thing you just described is very much in keeping with that previous kind of notion of like lower class, for example, or, you know, folks that don't have very much control over their lives, being able to kind of like get that out, or at least that frustration out by taking care of pets and feeling like superior. This takes it to a much more gendered and kind of offensive direction. Even the nice version that you just mentioned is a little bit sexist. The idea that women are lavishing all this attention on these animals because they're, you know, less than. Or, but then, you know, if you wanted to look at it in terms of the reality, I mean, it was a brutal time for women where men absolutely dominated all aspects of society and treated women like chattel, essentially. And of course, leave it to men to take this and turn it in even more of a horrible misogynist direction in saying that women and cats shared the same whorish disposition. In some way, they had qualities that were compared to sex workers or prostitutes, what they would have called. Just another way of kind of like, you know, keeping women down, and using this thing that might have been a nice respite from, you know, the horrors of male-dominated society, and turning it around as another way of kind of othering women and saying, yeah, of course you're hanging out with cats.
So there's a quote here. I want to warn people. This aged like milk. In 1855, author Alphonse Toussenel said, "An animal so keen on maintaining her appearance, so silky, so tiny, so eager for caresses, so ardent and responsive, so graceful and supple, an animal that makes the night her day and who shocks decent people with the noise of her orgies, can only have one single analogy in the world, and that analogy is of the feminine kind." And he goes on and on and on, and then at the very end, he says, "Of whom are we writing? Of the cat or of the other," meaning women. This guy must have been a lot of fun at parties and first dates.
Yeah, no doubt about it. He went on to double down and added, "Lazy and frivolous and spending entire days in contemplation and sleep while pretending to be hunting mice," referring to cats, I'm assuming, not women, "incapable of the least effort when it comes to anything repugnant, but indefatigable when it is a matter of pleasure, of play, of sex, love of the night." God, this guy's a real piece of work. Ooh. "The other here is women."
Yep. And then he goes on to talk about either the cat or the human female's ingratitude and aridity of heart. I think Alphonse had some stuff to work out. I think at the end, he didn't know which he was accusing of what. But anyhow, this leads us into the idea of the crazy cat lady. So it may have started, of course, with the concept of witches and familiars in the 1500s, in Europe at least. But by the late 1700s, we see the emergence of what will become the modern cat lady stereotype. Around this time, as many as 1 out of 5 women would not end up being married. And again, a very misogynistic time when women were evaluated as worthy or unworthy based on their whether or not they were married. So this was a huge problem in England at the time. The Protestant Reformation of the 1540s had made convents no longer really a thing. So if you are the head of a household, you can't just send your unmarried daughters off to the convent anymore. And there's a rock and a hard place situation because also it's unseemly if you're a woman for you to work. So unmarried women became like the way cats were characterized earlier. They became treated like appendages of their relatives' households. And they were called, that's where they, you know, they were called spinsters and things like that. And they often led lives, even if they were financially well-to-do and didn't have to worry about food or having shelter. They were often living these pretty isolated, unhappy lives, you know?
Yeah. I mean, it really is kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy, right? I mean, they're absolutely treated like second-class citizens. They're not given the opportunities to take care of themselves. And then they ultimately become this kind of like source for ridicule, like as if they have done something wrong or as if this is like a choice that they've made. It's really pretty disgusting. You had this kind of type emerge, and the most iconic version historically of the cat lady is someone by the name of Gertrude Savills, who lived in the time of King George in England, and was kind of seen as the archetype of the cat lady, and was parodied in cartoons, and was kind of seen as the prototypical cat lady. Moving into the Victorian era, the stereotypes of the old maid and like, you know, a bevy of like feline counterparts became such a kind of running gag that in an 1880 issue of the Dundee Courier, they declared that, quote, "the old maid would not be typical of her class without the cat, but one cannot exist without the other." So they were inextricably linked. And, you know, cats were at this time even viewed like we view them today largely as being pretty clever, very self-involved. Again, the idea of not really needing humans. But on the other hand, the spinsters or the old maids were seen as being somehow like kind of insane or eccentric, having burned all their bridges and squandered all their opportunities. The term blighted hopes was used in that Dundee Courier article. And here's a full quote. "Old maids and cats have long been proverbially associated together, and rightly or wrongly, these creatures have been looked upon with a certain degree of suspicion and aversion by a large proportion of the human race. There's nothing at all surprising in the old maid choosing a cat as a household pet or companion. Solitude is not congenial to human nature, and a poor, forlorn female shut up in a cheerless garret, brooding all alone over her blighted hopes," there it is, "would naturally center her affections on some of the lower animals, and none could be more congenial as a pet and companion than a kindly, purring pussy."
I conjecture that, etymologically speaking, this would be part of the reason, or around the same time, that we see the emergence of that slang word for genitalia, because of that association.
Mm-hmm. Now I was thinking the same thing. Okay. I think this is the perfect place to take a pause, and we'll resume this two-parter on Thursday. In the meantime, huge thanks to super producer Casey Pegram, Alex Williams, who composed our theme, Gabe Lousier, researcher extraordinaire.
Big, big thanks to Christopher Hasiotis. Big, big thanks to Yves Jeffcoat, who we need to have back on the show again. And of course, as always, big thanks to our own indoor-outdoor cat, Jonathan Strickland, a.k.a. The Quister. Go ahead, feel free to send some of your pet pictures our way. You can find us on the internet. Go to facebook.com, type in Ridiculous Historians. That is our show's community page. All you have to do is answer a question, something very easy, like identifying super producer Casey Pegram, my pal Noel, or myself, or just, you know, make us laugh, have a pun. And then you can find the show on Instagram and Twitter as well. It's probably going to be more enjoyable to follow us as individuals.
That's correct. You can find me on Instagram, where I am at @HowNowNoelBrown. How about you, sir?
Folks, cat fanciers and cat haters alike, you can find me and message me your pet pictures directly. I am at Ben Bolin on Instagram. I am at Ben Bolin HSW on Twitter. That's so weird that the Egyptian word for cat is mao.
Yeah, it's weird, but also makes too much sense. And hey, while you're on the internet, why not leave a review on Apple Podcasts or your podcast platform of choice, but preferably Apple Podcasts. It helps people discover the show and helps us, feel good about ourselves when you say nice things. We'll see you next time, folks. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.